First up this month, we tackle a long-debated archaeological question. How did agriculture spread across Europe? Very simply, some people argue that it was a spread of ideas, where farming technology moved outwards from the Near East, but the people learned from their neighbours and essentially stayed put. The people in the other camp argue that agriculture came with a certain group of people that moved through Europe and displaced the existing populations as they did so. Now, lending weight to the second theory is the evidence found by Alan Cooper and colleagues. They found one particular genetic haplogroup, N1A, which seems to turn up anywhere agriculture goes.
So what we're trying to do in this work is to investigate the genetic makeup of the first farming populations in Europe, which are about 10,000 years ago. The Neolithic period starts, and the Neolithic is defined as the invasion of farming technology, crops and animals. And this replaces the previous populations, or behaviour of the previous populations in Europe, which were largely hunter-gatherer nomadic groups. And it was a major transition, because once you start farming, you produce enough energy through all the free carbohydrate that you can establish quite complex civilizations. You can get specialization because there's enough food around that not everybody is out there gathering food and living hand to mouth, so that you can have some people who are free to, you know, design new technologies or invent interpretive dances or whatever else your culture might think is particularly valuable.
How do we think agriculture spread?
Perhaps in a simple format, the two opposing hypotheses, the two extreme hypotheses, genetic replacement hypothesis, which suggests that a completely new genetic culture moves into Europe at that point, and we're pretty sure it comes from the Near East, from the Fertile Crescent, because we can see, again from archaeology, that this is where farming evolved in Europe. And so if there had been a large genetic change in Europe when farmers come in, we would expect it to have come from the Near East. The opposing hypothesis is that the hunter-gatherers, the existing nomads who own Europe at that stage effectively, they learned how to farm. They either picked it up from watching these invaders from somewhere else, or perhaps they even interbred fairly extensively with these invading groups and adopted the technology. And that's the cultural diffusion hypothesis.
And you used ancient DNA to solve this riddle, but what are the kind of issues that you faced?
Well, the advantage of using ancient DNA is you can actually go back in time and directly address the question. So if the issue is, what was the genetic makeup of the first farming populations in Europe? Well, the best way to answer that is to actually go back and measure the DNA from these specimens. So we worked in central Germany, where the postdoc leading this research, Dr. Wolfgang Haack, has developed over many years an extensive relationship with a group of German archaeologists, such that he was able to obtain material that had not been extensively handled. This is one of the biggest problems in ancient DNA, is that specimens, when they come out of the ground, are often washed or handled by archaeologists. And in so doing, they cover the material and penetrate it even with their own DNA, making it incredibly difficult to determine what DNA sequence comes from the original specimen, because the DNA in the ancient specimen is very damaged and broken down. You know, trying to tell the difference between a Neanderthal and an archaeologist is obviously fairly difficult to start with. So working with damaged bits of DNA doesn't help you. In Germany, the big advantage was there'd been really extensive collaboration between the archaeologists and the ancient DNA researchers, so that when a skeleton was exposed, bodysuits and breathing masks and gloves were donned, and one or two teeth or a tooth and a bone sample were collected from the skeleton using sterile techniques and plastic bags sent off to the lab. And we were able to extract DNA from these specimens, secure in the knowledge that they hadn't been contaminated by subsequent handling. So what we tested was the mitochondrial DNA specifically, because it is easier to work with in ancient samples. Mitochondria are the small organelles that exist in eukaryotic cells and provide energy effectively for us. And they were originally free living bacteria, so they have the remnants of their original genomes there, and they are strictly maternally inherited. One other advantage of mitochondrial DNA is that you have thousands of copies of mitochondria or thousands of mitochondria in every cell. so that the chances of finding mitochondrial DNA in an ancient specimen which has undergone degradation is much, much higher than trying to find the single copy nuclear genes. So we retrieved the mitochondrial DNA from large numbers of individuals from a graveyard in Derenburg near Halle in central Germany. And in this particular site, there's large numbers of skeletons. Actually, it's an amazing site, this area. There's preservation of skeletons and graveyards that go from the earliest Neolithic, from a culture called the linear band ceramic or ceramic, which refers to the type of pots that they made, right the way through to the Iron Age, almost continuously. So it represents an enormous slice of time that we can follow the cultural and archaeological changes using DNA, which is quite unique.
What did you find out once you had identified the old haplogroups?
What we found when we analysed the LPK population, and we did about, I think it was 23, 24 individuals, and then when we combined the data with previous studies of LBK, we had about 40 in total, which is enough to get a reasonable look at the population. We found quite a different genetic makeup to the mitochondrial DNA that had been observed in the specimens of the hunter-gatherer populations that predated the Neolithic. Before 10,000 years ago, the specimens that had been looked at in Europe had all come back with a mitochondrial sequence that we term U. All the mitochondrial clades are named after letters in the alphabet. And so U4 and U5 were the particular markers that characterized the hunter-gatherer populations. But in the LBK population, we found almost none of those. I think we found one out of about 40, which suggested that those original hunter-gatherer populations had almost no genetic input into the first farming cultures in Europe. Instead, what we found was quite a strange makeup, including a large number of very rare DNA type today. It's a mitochondrial type we term N1A. This particular marker is now in less than 1% of the population, but made up a fair chunk of this LBK group.
And who matches N1A today?
The closest match is definitely in Anatolia and the Levant, so Turkey, Northern Iraq, Iran. That's the closest match you'd find to the genetic sequences we see 10,000 years ago in the middle of Germany, confirming that the genetic replacement hypothesis was correct. The first farmers that came to Europe were a completely different bunch of skilled migrants, if you like, who came in and replaced almost completely the hunter-gatherers that were there previously.
But the hunter-gatherer haplogroup is most prevalent today, so what does that mean?
The inference was that the hunter-gatherers had done rather well and somehow had survived and had made a major contribution to the genetics of the modern European population. So actually, that had been interpreted as evidence for the cultural diffusion hypothesis, the idea that the hunter-gatherers had learned how to farm somehow. What we can see from the ancient DNA data is that while it is true that the modern European population has this good chunk of haplogroup H and a few other types that seem to be clearly pre-Neolithic, so they've only become that common, actually relatively recently. And I guess that's probably the take-home message we're getting out of the studies we've done so far. There's much more to come. But already we can see that human genetic history in places like Europe and other parts of the world where we've been working is incredibly dynamic. It represents extinctions and replacements and migrations, and it's huge waves coming in from Eurasia and then coming, you know, and the next wave's coming from the Iberian Peninsula, and then there's another wave coming in from the east. It's incredibly dynamic. And in many ways, it mirrors what we've seen from studies of ancient DNA from megafauna, for example, or other animal populations. And I'm of the opinion that this is actually a much more accurate view of how evolution works.
So our populations today are a result of lots of travelling and families superseding others. I think it's astonishing that nearly half of Europeans alive today are descended from one woman who lived 30,000 years ago. Speaking just then was Alan Cooper. He's director of the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA at the University of Adelaide, and you can find his work in PLOS Biology.